You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We will welcome in a current and a former congressman from Wisconsin during this hour and give you an opportunity to ask questions about issues facing the nation. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We will talk about a wide variety of issues facing Congress, from the budget and tax reform and health care to foreign policy issues as well. Let me welcome our first guest. Very happy to have with us Mike Gallagher, first-term Republican U.S. Representative from Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District, which includes the cities of Green Bay, Appleton, and Marinette. Good morning.
Morning, Joy. It's great to be with you.
It's nice to have you back. Now, you are on recess right now, but you say that you should be doing your job instead. You introduced a do-your-job bill. What would this legislation do?
Yeah, I think the term recess itself kind of exposes the absurdity of what we're doing here. We're off for 2 weeks, and we know when we come back, we have 3 days in which to find a way to fund the government. The continuing resolution expires in 3 days. And if we operate under a prolonged continuing resolution, that is going to wreak havoc on our military, among many other programs, as all the service chiefs testified to last week. So I think that's responsible. I think they should lock us on the House floor until we figure this thing out, as well as all the other problems that need fixing in this country. I know I'm new. Perhaps that sounds naive, but as anyone in Northeast Wisconsin knows, if you do not show up and get your job done, then you do not get paid, you don't get a promotion, and I don't think we should take a vacation until we get our job done. So my bill would basically prevent Congress from going into recess for a prolonged period of time until we figured out how to fund the government and restored regular order, which we haven't had for years. In other words, a process through which Congress authorizes and appropriates funds for the government, which has really been in disarray for a decade.
So I take it your bill wasn't well received, or at least it didn't pass immediately.
That is putting it mildly, Joy. Yes, it was not a popular proposal, but it is a common sense proposal, and I get it. You always encounter this reaction in D.C., particularly among people that have been there for a while, and they just sort of shrug and say, "Well, this isn't how we do things." Well, precisely. I mean, how we're doing things isn't working. So let us come together and figure out a better way of doing things. Yeah. It works for the American people, not just for the political class in D.C. So I think the common sense wisdom of Wisconsin far supersedes the status quo, nonsensical way people do business in Washington, D.C.
So we will talk about a variety of domestic and foreign policy issues, but what are you planning on doing during this recess? Are you planning town hall meetings, for example, or listening sessions?
We've just been meeting with as many people as possible. We had kind of a mini town hall at a company up in Door County yesterday, toured a bunch of hospitals, doing a lot of one-on-one meetings with constituents. We call it coffee with your congressman. So trying to meet with as many people as possible, see as many parts of the district as possible, hear from as many people as possible. It's helpful for me to just get people's thoughts on whether it's on health care, whether it's on foreign policy. I find I learn a lot from it, and so that's helpful. And I understand that there is this desire for people to get back to the district and hear from their constituents and interact. But above all, I think our constituents sent us to Washington, D.C. to get the job done and to fix problems. And I think that is more important than people spending time raising money, which, let's be honest, that's what people are going to spend the majority of their time off doing.
Well, I know that health care was a very important issue to you. And the reform did not succeed in the Republican-controlled Congress, but now we're hearing that President Trump is saying that he's working with the Freedom Caucus, and it looks like we might have a health care reform package coming up soon. What do you know?
I don't know much more than that, if I'm being completely honest with you. I haven't been a part of those discussions. What I find interesting about the health care debate, notwithstanding how divisive it may seem, really both parties are going at each other over this question of how we finance health insurance, right? I mean, Obamacare was health insurance reform. It wasn't health care reform. And now we have our own sort of answer to that. But really, that is a secondary question. The question of how we finance health insurance isn't that important if we don't find a way to tackle and control what's actually driving up the cost of health care in this country, which was going up prior to the ACA and continues to go up. And until we really discuss and tackle the root drivers of health care costs in this country, we're just shuffling deck chairs on the Titanic right now. So my hope is that both sides will come together to talk about that. And I found that when you turn the conversation to things like, how do we have more transparency in pricing so you actually understand what you're buying when you shop for health care? How do we change the incentive structure through which doctors and hospitals operate so they can take intelligent risk and invest in population-centric healthcare? How do we tackle rising drug costs? How do we allow nurses to have more responsibility, particularly in rural areas? Those things become a space where both sides can have a productive conversation, and the solutions, I think, are there and pretty exciting. And so my hope is that we tackle that at the same time we continue to try and figure out this difficult question of how we finance access to health insurance.
John in Appleton is with us. Hello, John.
Well, yes, on the topic of healthcare, I can understand that we really need to deal with the prices. But what does it say about the values of the Republican Party and what our country looks like to the rest of the world that you would vote to take away 24 million people from life-saving health insurance?
Were you trying to take health insurance away from 24 million people, Congressman Gallagher?
No. And I just think, I mean, can we all just kind of, you know, holster our weapons here and the talking points that we get from groups that honestly have an interest in fostering conflict between both sides? And as a result, what happens? Nothing ever gets solved. Can we come together as Americans and say, hey, we have people that are losing coverage now. We have people that's premiums are going up. Average family premiums going from 13,000 to 17,000 people. We have a system that, to quote the head of Aetna, claims it is in a death spiral. We all know that the status quo is unsustainable, and we want the same thing, right? We want people to have access to insurance that works for them and a system that's flexible where people get the care they need. So rather than accusing each side of being unpatriotic or wanting to literally throw people on the street or kill people, which I find offensive, let's come together as a country and figure out how we fix a difficult problem.
Eric in Madison is with us. Hello, Eric.
Hi. I think that you should repeal the bill from 73 that took health care from a nonprofit to a profit-driven system. And you mentioned Aetna. The CEO of Aetna, I think, earns around $15 million a year, which it probably donates, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Republicans' campaign. So why would they stop anything?
Well, Eric said that he wanted the Medicare for All bill to be considered. What do you think of that, Congressman Gallagher?
Well, I think the only problem with that is that Medicare's financing don't work right now. I mean, it's going bankrupt. It's a critical program that we actually need to figure out how we make sure it's there for people that rely upon it, like my grandma, whose livelihood depends on it. And if you talk to any hospitals, they'll say Medicare for All means Medicare for none. And so I don't want us to get in a situation where, in, you know, with good intentions, we try and do something that actually takes down the entire healthcare system in this country. And again, like I said before, let's actually focus on why healthcare costs continue to rise in this country, because me as a millennial, a younger guy, I just need catastrophic coverage, right? And I think there's a lot of people in my generation that need that. And indeed, that was the critical flaw in the reason Obamacare didn't work, because you had, you know, all the 26 to 34-year-olds or 18 to 34-year-olds who didn't buy into the system. We just did the math and said, I'll pay the penalty, because it actually makes more financial sense for me to pay the penalty rather than having to buy a plan that I cannot afford and indeed gives me coverage I don't need. So we need more flexibility in the marketplace. And then the gentleman's specific question, Joy?
Well, that was what he was going to be asking, and then
okay.
He wanted to say that Aetna gave a lot of money to Republicans, but I don't know if we need.
Well, I have no doubt. I mean, you raised an interesting question about, you know, if we have a system in which only the insurance companies continue to profit, who loses out in that system? Well, it's patients, it's families, it's people that we should actually want to serve. So I would be interested in proposals that allow the middlemen to take less of a slice of the pie and instead focus our resources on actually giving care. And if you talk to physicians, like my sister, who's a OBGYN down near Milwaukee, she says it's getting to a point where she feels like she just can't do her job, right? Because, you know, she has to order a battery of tests in order to protect herself against litigation. And if you talk to hospitals, and it's not just the big hospitals, It's our community health centers, like the one I went to in Appleton 2 days ago. We're on the front lines, serving the populations that are most vulnerable. These are people living at or below the poverty line who don't have any other access to health care. They're doing incredible work. Even they will say, listen, the problem is we've had to spend so much of our resources on administrative costs in the last few years, as opposed to on recruiting more physicians or nurses, or, you know, experimenting with ways where we can convince people to eat healthier. And so we don't have to deal with the downstream effects of things like obesity and diabetes, which are driving up healthcare costs. We are misallocating our resources in the healthcare community right now. And we're, as a result, people are getting less healthy. I mean, life expectancy went down last year for the first time in a long time.
Let me jump in and we'll check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then more questions for Congressman Mike Gallagher after the news. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are continuing our ongoing series of interviews with Wisconsin's congressional delegation. From time to time, we invite members of Congress to join us to talk with you and to answer your questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Today, we are happy to have with us Mike Gallagher, Republican U.S. Representative from Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District, which includes Green Bay, Appleton, and Marinette. And we have another caller. Chris in Port Wing is with us. Hello, Chris.
Good day, and thank you, Congressman, for taking time out to be on the public radio. I really appreciate it. I want to ask, do you support the planned budget cuts in the Trump budget that would eliminate $180 million of WIC funding, cut about 32% of EPA funding, and basically mandate that we ignore important issues like climate change in order to raise the military budget by $52 billion?
Well, there's a specific question, Congressman Gallagher. Oh, do we, I think, Congressman Gallagher, are you there? So I'm going to have to ask Niaja to call our guest back, because we seem to have lost him. And in the meantime, I will give you our number again, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We have lost Mike Gallagher, so you need to call him back. And we will get him on the line. Coming up in just a few minutes, we will be welcoming in Dave Obey, a former Democratic U.S. representative from Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. And we will talk with him about some of these same domestic and foreign policy issues. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org.
Joy, can you hear me?
There you are. Okay, good. I'm glad we
have
you.
Hey, sorry, I was talking. I could hear you. My apologies.
We have some kind of strange gremlin in the phone system. So anyway, good. I'm glad you're there. And so the question was, do you support the increase in military spending at the expense of deep cuts in domestic programs?
Well, first of all, I don't support the false choice that we've forced on ourselves through sequestration over the last few years. If you remember, sequestration was intended to force both sides to come to the table to talk about what's actually driving up our debt, to talk about the 70% of our funding that just goes out the door without any congressional review. So basically now, that never happened, but we're still under this situation where for every pound of defense spending, we need to find a pound of non-defense discretionary spending, which is the precisely wrong way you would want to do budgeting. I mean, it doesn't actually save that money over the long term, and it results in enormous damage not only to the Defense Department, but to a lot of domestic programs that are essential. If you know, I came out in opposition to the president's proposed cut for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. So to answer the caller's question, how this works historically and how it's working right now is the president proposes and then Congress disposes. So we're taking a look at every single aspect of this budget, and where we agree, we'll agree. Where we disagree, like on the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. But we have to get out from under sequester. It's killing us. I mean, and as for this military increase, which I think the caller was not happy with, I just would encourage you to look at the testimony of all the service chiefs as what's happening to our military. This $54 billion is only a 3% increase over Obama. It doesn't get us where we need to be. We're still historically below the average of what we're spending on a per GDP basis for our military. And I happen to believe that this is an investment in our own security. A strong military is a bargain compared to a weak one that invites our adversaries to test us and drags us into unnecessary and costly wars. So we have to be forward engaged and forward deployed and have a more peaceful world if we're to prosper economically here at home. So I just would reject this false choice, and we got to find a way to have a budgeting process that tackles that 70% of money that's just going out the door. And your elected representatives don't even take a look at it every single year.
Did you support President Trump's decision to launch airstrikes in Syria?
I did. I thought it was the right call. I was on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee when the former president came in 2013 after Bashar al-Assad killed about 1,200 people in East Ghouta in Syria. And he asked for an authorization. We actually passed it out of the Senate committee, and it never went anywhere because he obviously backed away from that and struck a deal with the Russians. And I think that was the wrong decision. And I think we've seen our credibility both in the Middle East and around the world slide as a result. So I think a limited proportional strike sends the right signal. Specifically, it sends a signal to Assad that he cannot use chemical weapons with impunity, that he can expect a strong U.S. response if he does so. Again, I think it sends a signal to the Russians that they need to rethink their support of Assad, as well as their de facto alliance with Iran that has really been the most remarkable development in the Middle East of the last 2 years. And I think it sends a signal around the world that the U.S. is no longer going to stand idly by while dictators and tyrants and two-bit terrorist groups challenge our interests. And imagine you're sitting there at a dinner with President Xi in China, and then you leave, you authorize a strike in Syria, and you come back, you finish your dinner, and you say, well, we just made a decision to strike in Syria. I think that actually increases the credibility of our military deterrent when it comes to the thorny issue of North Korea. And military deterrence is critical, and having that credibility is critical because that's how you achieve a peaceful diplomatic outcome. As Wisconsin native George Kennan was fond of saying, you have no idea how much it contributes to the general politeness and pleasantness of U.S. diplomacy to have a little quiet armed force in the background. So kind of to tie it to what your earlier caller was expressing concern about the military, the point of having a strong military is not so we can go around the world and fight wars. It is indeed the opposite. It is for the avoidance of wars. It is for the preservation of peace. It is peace through strength. That is what we need to restore.
Let's take a call from Jonathan in Wasaki next. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi, I was asking about some threats coming out of North Korea lately and something big happening Saturday morning, apparently, in North Korea. I wonder if the congressman had to say about that.
Yeah, so it's the anniversary of Kim Il-sung, who's Kim Jong-un's grandfather, who's really the founder of the modern state of North Korea. And so the expectation is that they are going to commemorate that celebration by launching another missile, so which would be a very provocative act in light of what Secretary Tillerson, Secretary Mattis, and the president has said recently, and indeed what appears to be a changing posture on the part of the Chinese. So we'll see. I think since we engaged in diplomacy in the 90s under the Clinton administration and then subsequently embarked on the policy of strategic patience with North Korea, our policy really has been ineffective and has failed. And as evidence of that, North Korea's nuclear arsenal continues to grow. And more troubling is the delivery systems on which it could put a nuclear warhead. They are in pursuit of an intercontinental ballistic missile that could strike our western seaboard. In other words, that would present an unacceptable threat to our own security. And so we have to find a way to convince them to abandon their nuclear program and hopefully resolve this peacefully, but we have to be prepared to take action in event that they present an unacceptable threat to our own homeland security.
President Trump, a reverse course on his view of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, yesterday, saying that it is no longer obsolete after months of bashing the alliance. So your thoughts on President Trump's reversals on a few foreign policy related issues.
Well, listen, I'm glad to hear him voice support for NATO. NATO has been the most successful post-war alliance in our history. It's vital. We need to find a way to modernize it. I think our allies, our NATO allies, should be contributing more and meeting their 2% of GDP contribution threshold, which only 5 out of the 28 countries have met in recent years. So I support the calls for convincing our allies to put more skin in the game. But that doesn't mean we scrap the alliance. And so I'm glad the president has evolved in his thinking. I'll admit I had a lot of questions about the president's thinking when it came to Russia. And so I've been heartened in recent weeks to see what I think is a shift and a sense that they understand that Putin doesn't share our interests, whether it's in Syria or across the broader Middle East or in eastern Ukraine, that Putin is a thug, a tyrant, the head of an autocratic petro-state that wants to destroy NATO and thinks the dissolution of the Soviet Union was the greatest disaster of the 20th century. So I welcome that. I think the president has a great team in place. I worked for H.R. McMaster for a year. He's an exceptional public servant and a true warrior scholar. I served under Jim Mattis when I was on active duty as well. He is an exceptional man who puts the interests of the country ahead of his own comforts or his career. And so he has good people. And I think as they develop an interagency process that harnesses those talents and gives the president good options, we'll see more foreign policy successes. And I think it's significant, just on the question of China and North Korea, that the president sent Secretary Mattis on his first trip abroad as Secretary of Defense to reassure all our Asian allies, Japan foremost among them, and send a message that the U.S. will remain forward engaged. We are not going to retreat further on the world stage. They sent a THAAD missile battery to South Korea to deter both the Chinese and the North Koreans. So there are some positive steps happening. As a member of Congress, I believe it's my duty to force Congress to reassert its role on foreign policy, which it has unilaterally surrendered to the executive branch over the last three decades. Both parties have done that, and that's wrong.
And we will hopefully talk to you again. We'll let you do your job and talk to you about other issues in the future.
Good tie-in, Joy. That was a good tie-in. Thank you.
Mike Gallagher, a first-term Republican U.S. Representative from Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. We invite members of Wisconsin's congressional delegation to talk with us and with you from time to time. And we kind of go through a rotation. A current Democratic member of Congress was unavailable to join us today, but we are very happy to have back with us a former member of Congress. Former Democratic U.S. Representative Dave Obey is our guest, and we will welcome your questions for him about how things are going in Washington, D.C., and a variety of domestic and foreign policy issues facing the nation. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Dave Obey, former Democratic U.S. Representative from Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District, which includes Wausau, Superior, and Rhinelander. He served for 42 years, including two stints as chairman of the House Appropriations Committee and 10 years as chairman of the Foreign Relations Appropriations Subcommittee. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for being with us. Representative Gallagher, who just joined us in our first half hour, talked to us about a bill that he introduced that would cut back on recesses for Congress. He says Congress should stay in session and not be on recess right now until a budget is passed. What do you think of that idea?
Well, I think the problem is that the Congress has developed some very bad habits the past few years. When they have come into session late in the afternoon on Tuesday, and by Thursday afternoon, they've been begging to go home. That you simply don't have enough time to get your work done when that happens. You also don't get to know your colleagues and get to understand people across the aisle because you never spend any time with them.
Yeah.
For most of the time that I was in the Congress, we would be coming into town a lot earlier, like Monday evening, for instance, and we would be leaving at Friday around 3 o'clock. That gave us a day and a half more to do our work, and it made all the difference. There was some slippage on that score the last two or three years, but but you simply can't do your work unless you do your work, and you can't do your work unless you're around to do it.
Yeah. Well, there's so much to talk about. I think I'm going to just start with an open-ended question, though, Congressman Obie, and ask you what's garnered your attention in Washington? What is the thing that concerns you the most, or that gives you hope?
Well, I think that the beginning of the Trump administration has been the most chaotic in my memory. And I think that creates a tremendous uncertainty, not only here at home, but abroad, and that's very dangerous. In terms of issues, what has distressed me the most is that instead of trying to find common ground and trying to find ways that you can repair Obamacare and update it, the House Republican leadership spent all of its time simply posing for political holy pictures by saying that they were going to repeal it and they were going to do it only on the Republican side of the aisle. That just doesn't work. I mean, if you take a look at the proposition they finally came up with, it was horrendous. I mean, who on earth believes that you make things better by adopting legislation which strips more than $20 million? I mean, which strips more than 20 million people from decent health care, and at the same time increases people's premiums and increases their deductibles and decreases affordability. There have been plenty of political points scored on both sides of the aisle. Now, instead of asking whether or not the product is sufficiently conservative in order to receive the support of the House, members simply ought to be asking, is this practical? Does it work? How can it help reduce cost? How can it assure that if you're unlucky in this world and you get a bad disease, that you don't go bankrupt?
Yeah. Well, now the reports out of Washington is that there could be some sort of health care change package, reform package that President Trump is working with, or Paul Ryan is working with, that Freedom Caucus to give us a health care bill. What do you think it needs, or what do you think it'll have?
Well, the problem with that is that they're making the bill even worse in terms of being able to appeal to moderates rather than the far right of the Republican caucus. What I find amazing is that the general impression that people have had is that Donald Trump might come after the safety net hammer and tong, and that maybe you can get a moderate response out of Speaker Ryan so that he can ease the problems that Trump is creating. In fact, it's turned out to be just the opposite. During the campaign, Mr. Trump said that he would see to it that everybody was covered and that he would see to it that it was done at a fraction of the previous cost. Instead, you have this monstrosity that was produced by the Republican leadership, and it's no wonder that a number of Republicans themselves said, hell no, we won't go. We're not going to support something that makes life more miserable rather than less for so many people.
Stand by, Congressman Obie, as we are going to check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll get into some more specific issues that are facing the nation, facing Congress. And we welcome your questions, too, at 1-800-642-1234. This is the the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with former Democratic U.S. Representative Dave Obey about issues facing the nation, issues before Congress. Welcoming your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. What's the issue nationally that matters most to you? What are you hoping Congress does about issues that it's taking up? We just talked about President Trump's proposed 2018 budget. It includes an increase in defense spending and offsetting cuts to domestic programs, some big eliminations of programs, including, as I just mentioned, federal funding of libraries and arts and humanities and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, among others. Dave Obey, what issues within the budget are you watching most closely?
Well, the issue of general priorities. I mean, if you take a look at what the White House seems to be supporting, it's atrocious for the middle class. I don't really believe that the American people want to see student aid squeezed and slashed. I don't think the American people want to see transportation programs short-sheeted. I don't think they want to see food stamps cut again and again. I don't think they want to see cuts in medical research such as Parkinson's or Lou Gehrig's disease. I don't think they want to hurt the middle class, which needs Medicaid in order to pay for nursing costs or nursing home costs if grandma has a stroke. So the budget is crafted to do only one thing, to cut virtually every piece of the safety net domestically and use that money to provide yet another tax cut for America's highest income people. I don't believe that fits what the country wants or needs.
Oh, another issue is a matter of government funding. Last year, Congress passed a continuing resolution to fund the government until the end of this month. In order to avoid a partial government shutdown, the current Congress must pass something to address this, and Republicans are considering an omnibus budget bill to fund the government until the end of this year. Given your experience in Congress, are you confident that the funding will be addressed on time?
Well, I cannot believe that they would be irresponsible enough to let the government shut down again. I would be amazed if they hadn't learned their lesson. But Congressman Gallagher was correct when he said that the sequestration process, which is now governing things, is irresponsible and mindless. The Republicans in the House need to stop overreaching. They try to turn every action into an opportunity to cut taxes for people on the high end of the income scale at the expense of cutting services that middle income and poor people need. I just don't think that suits the economic needs of the country. It certainly doesn't suit the moral needs.
Yeah, you know, President Trump was giving an interview yesterday where he said that his big plans for tax reform are going to be delayed. They're not going to happen as fast as he wanted them to happen. He says health care has to happen first, or he wants health care to happen first, then tax reform. He thinks it'll happen before the end of the year, but certainly not in his first 100 days. What's your reaction?
Well, I mean, with respect to health care, the public needs to understand the Republican leadership in Congress and in the White House is playing a word game. Mr. Trump, during the campaign, told people that he would see to it that whatever they did on health care, that everyone would be covered and that everyone be able to see their prices go down and their premiums go down and their copays go down. If Mr. Trump produces a health care bill like that, that would be wonderful. But instead, he has now adopted, he's been hijacked by the Ryan forces in the Congress on this issue. And so now they are pretending that if they give, quote, access to health care, that is the same as coverage. I mean, access is theoretical. It has to be affordable. And and Obamacare needs to be updated and repaired, because it's been, after all, almost 7 years since it passed, and we will have learned things from the first round on Obamacare. We need to repair that to bring down premiums, to bring down copayments, and that's what people ought to be working on. And to do that, you need to have a bipartisan approach. Mm-hmm. We've had enough of partisanship on that issue.
What about tax reform?
Well, tax reform sounds great, but it depends on what you mean by it. Mm-hmm. Mr. Ryan appears to think that tax reform means that you increase the benefits that go to the highest income people, and do it at the expense of middle income and lower income people. I just don't think that's what people think of when they think of tax reform. I don't think they believe that the top 1% has been abused at the by everybody else in society. If we had decent priorities, we would be looking at issues that we need to wrestle with in order to improve the lives of middle income and low income people.
Let's move our conversation to some foreign policy issues now. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson met with Russian President Vladimir Putin yesterday. The two men appeared unable to agree on the facts involving the chemical weapons attack on Syrian civilians or Russian interference in the American election. Mr. Tillerson told reporters, "There is a low level of trust between our two countries." What concerns do you have about our relationship with Russia?
Well, I mean, my biggest problem is that we've sent mixed signals to Mr. Putin. The fact is that if you take a look at the Middle East alone, we created a terrible problem when we invaded Iraq and dumped Saddam Hussein. Right now, our biggest problem in the Middle East is Iran and Syria, and the fact is that both of those countries were benefited greatly, and their power was increased greatly when we invaded Iraq, because we eliminated the only political counterweight to Syria and Iran in the region. So that has given Putin more of an opportunity to become a bigger player in the Middle East. Secondly, with respect to Russia itself, after the Iron Curtain fell, George Bush Sr. did a terrific job, in my view, in dealing with the collapse of the Soviet Union and work to try to help the Soviet Union to convert to a more market-oriented economy, and then that fell apart because of Russia's basic instability. So then what happened is that the West began to expand NATO, which Putin was very much suspicious of, and so he began to try to look for ways to obtain a reverse leverage. But then Mr. Trump started to come along telling people that NATO was outmoded and gave the impression that we were going to can it. That was a disastrous and confusing signal that was sent to the Russians. And so right now it is imperative that America develop a coherent policy toward Russia and NATO. We cannot afford to let Putin think that he can play games with democracy, not just in the American election, but also in the French election, the Belgian election, the German election. That's what he's doing. He's playing a meddling game in all of those areas, and that's a very dangerous game that we cannot let him continue to to play.
Yeah, just in the last day or so, President Trump now says NATO is no longer obsolete. He did reverse positions on things he said during the campaign about China and Russia and Syria. What do you think's going on there with President Trump? Is it the realities of the office, or what do you think?
Well, all I know is that I have a severe case of whiplash trying to follow Mr. Trump's changing positions on foreign policy. He started out knowing nothing, and his policy showed that. Now he's hopefully on a rapid learning curve, but it's a very dangerous time for us. Putin needs to understand that we do not mean to threaten Russia, but we will not tolerate his involving himself in the domestic affairs of either the United States or our allies. And we need to be steady on that score. I don't know where he or Mr. Trump got his initial ideas on foreign policy, but they were highly dangerous and highly confusing, and we're paying a price for that now.
And finally, we just have a minute to go. Do you have any additional thoughts on the almost first 100 days of the Trump administration?
Well, I just think that Mr. Trump needs to remember what he promised the American people. He said that he would support health care, which gave meaningful coverage to everyone at reasonable prices. That's a tall order. And to get that done, he's going to need to work with progressive forces. If you want to drive down cost, and I heard Congressman Gallagher mention this, if you want to drive down cost in the healthcare area, the best way you can do that, in my view, is to move to a Medicare for all proposal. But the Republicans aren't going to accept that, and so if they won't accept that, then they need to accept some other ideas that will help, as the congressman said, to make pricing more transparent, and at the same time to make certain that in these individual markets, insurance is made more affordable than it is right now.
Thank you so much for being with us. Dave Obey, former Democratic U.S. Representative from Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. Thank you to Brianne Chasso and Naisha Ellison for producing the program. This is the Ideas Network.